So we are excited to be in Leviticus chapter 21. For those of you who are brand new around here, or you're not exactly sure what you just got yourself involved in when you showed up today, we're in the middle of a series called Secret Agents. And the concept of this series is that we are God's representatives on earth. God has always had his representatives on earth. He's always had some people on earth who are sort of his special representatives. And by the time you get to the New Testament, we find out that everybody who would claim to be a follower of Jesus is his ambassador, his representative, his agent on the planet. And it just so happens there's an Old Testament book called Leviticus where God is trying to describe to his people what it means for them to be agents of God on the earth. And then also specifically for the priests who are supposed to represent God to the other people of Israel, for God to tell them what it means for them to represent him. So our idea for the last couple of weeks has been, if the book of Leviticus is instructions on how people 3,500 years ago should represent God, then even though lots of our society has changed, and even though our relationship with God today is a little bit different than it was back then, we still might have some principles for what does it mean to represent God well in our modern day world from the book of Leviticus. So we've been studying it. And I want to start you out today with a question that will help set the stage for what we're going to be talking about. And the question is this: how do you respond to someone with unreasonably high expectations? Seriously, how do you respond to that other person who has their standards way up high, completely outlandishly high, and you come face to face with them and you have to somehow decide what you're going to do? Maybe some of you are in school right now. My wife was up to like 5 o'clock in the morning this morning because she's got a homework assignment in one class at Purdue. I mean, just, and some of you are grad students, you know this thing. Your professor, your advisor is asking you to do some insane thing that no one in their right mind would ever do, and yet you're getting paid to do it, or you're not, or you're paying them to ask them to do it, for them to ask you to do it. So I know that you've experienced this before. How do you deal with it when someone has unreasonably high expectations for you? When I was in high school, some of you know my background. I am a self-avowed nerd. I was very good at the academic pursuits of high school. And when I was in high school, I remember I had this one teacher that I didn't like. She was our history professor and teacher. And so she was our history teacher, and she asked us to do this one paper. Any research topic that we wanted, but it was one of these history research topic things. And I don't know about your life growing up, but in my life growing up, anytime the teacher had asked me to do a paper, my papers basically consisted of doing something that you would never think of doing today, because today you have Wikipedia. But back then, what I would do is I would open up the one encyclopedia we had, and I would look up the topic that I was supposed to write on, and I would try to sort of learn something from the encyclopedia and write something about it. And my mom would get frustrated with me, and so she would come into my room and she would actually sit down next to me as I was on my Commodore 64 trying to type up my paper. She would sit down next to me with the encyclopedia open on her lap, and she would literally paraphrase the encyclopedia to me, and I would type her paper. I have no idea why she thought this was a good thing to do, but I got pretty good grades. And in the process, plagiarized a whole lot. So when it came to high school, I decided I wanted to do things on my own. I wanted to write papers on my own. And so I started doing this. I would read the encyclopedia myself, and then I would put it off to the side, and I would sit down in front of my computer, and I would write my own papers. Imagine that. I would write my own assignments. And I was doing pretty well at this until I got to Mrs. Hinn's class. And she asked us to do this one paper. I did the same method. I read my encyclopedia. I put it off to the side. I went back to here, and I had done a lot of other research, too. I looked up in books. I had note cards. I had an outline. I did the whole nine yards. It's now time for the rough draft. And so I write my rough draft, submit it to my teacher, and a week later, we all get our rough drafts back. And on the top of my rough draft was a letter I had never seen before in academic contexts. It was written in red at the top of my paper, a big curve with a plus sign next to it. And I was like, I've never seen a curvy letter on the top of one of my papers before. They usually have pointy tips. And the curve was confusing me. And so I was thinking, okay, that's not my paper. So I was going to hand it to the person behind me. And then I looked and my name is on the top. I'm like, C plus, do C's exist in academics? I didn't understand this. So I literally thought something had been done wrong. I went up to the teacher afterwards and I said, what are you smoking? No, I didn't say it. I said, tell me what this is all about. Am I missing something? Did something go wrong here? This is a rough draft. And my mindset was rough draft. No one's doing a good job. It's a rough draft. You're supposed to be able to revise it. As long as you turn it in, then you've accomplished the goal of the assignment. That's what I thought. So I tell her, and she says this to me. Imagine the gall of a woman who would say this to a high school student. All your information was fine, but there was nothing to connect one thing to the other. There was no logical flow to the paper. And I'm like, logical flow? I got all the information down. It's all right. Nothing's wrong. My grammar is right. My spelling is right. I have paragraphs. We're all good. And she says, no. And so I was like, what do I need to do then? She says, well, I'm talking about connecting your thoughts one to another. You know, like use words like therefore or however to sort of connect a thought from one sentence to the next sentence and from one paragraph to the next paragraph. And I left her presence. I was like, what is this lady doing? So I got back to my house in front of my little Commodore 64. And out of vengeance, I decided I was just going to slap therefores and howevers and neverthelesses at the beginning of every sentence. 100%. I was just going to, every single sentence was going to have a therefore or a however or a nevertheless or a moreover or something in front of it. Whatever word I could come up with was just going to be at the beginning of every sentence. And you know what happened? Something weird happened. I slapped a therefore in front of a sentence and it didn't make sense anymore. So I had to change the sentence so that the sentence was connecting with the previous sentence. And as I did that more and more, I got lots of sentences that got changed. And I had lots of howevers and therefores and neverthelesses. And my mind is all still in just revenge mode. So I get done with the paper and I've got therefores all over the place. And I basically slam it down on her desk. I'm like, final draft, there you go. And she grades it, and I got an A on the thing. I was like, see, it's all her fault. She's like, therefore, and so I do the therefore, and then I get it back. And I read it, and I was like, amazed at the fact that my paper actually made sense. All of those changes and modifications had actually produced something that was better than it was before. And in my vengeance, perfectionist, whatever it is you want to call it, I actually ended up becoming a better writer in history class because of Mrs. Hins, of all things. What's your response when someone has unreasonably high expectations for you? In general, I think we have three responses. There's the perfectionist among us. And the perfectionist says, whatever the person tells me I need to do, I'm just going to do it. Sometimes the perfectionist operates out of a sense of personal pride. Sometimes the perfectionist operates in a sense of revenge. It doesn't really matter. You're still a perfectionist. And you're like, I'm just going to do the thing and get it done to the letter. Some of you, however, are not perfectionists. You would call yourselves maybe pragmatists. And your mindset is, well, I'm just going to do the best I can. And if that person expects more of me, they're just wrong. I'm just going to do the best I can. And if they tell me I can't measure up to their standards, it's because they got stupid standards. You know, so I'm just going to blame the other person. The pragmatist says, I'm just going to blame the person with the standards that are too high. Then there's another kind of person. I don't know what to call him. Well, I'll just call him a pessimist. Let's call him a pessimist. And they're the person who says, I'm never going to measure up to anybody's standards, so why bother? I'm just not going to do anything. So the teacher asked me to do something, so what? I'm just going to do whatever I feel like, and whatever grade I get, that's what I get, and that's what we do. I don't know what kind of person you are, but I want to tell you something. Today we come face to face with a couple chapters in Leviticus that highlight something that should have been obvious for you so far. It is that God is a perfectionist, and his standards are unimaginably high. Let me take you to chapter 21. It's on page 83 of the Bibles that we pass out here, but you find it in your own Bible or on the live event, and I'm just going to read most of it here. and we're going to make our way through it. It says this, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Speak to the priests, the sons of Aaron, and say to them, a priest must not make himself ceremonially unclean for any of his people who die.'" Now, we've already found out that in God's rules, if you were in the same room as a dead person, then you became unclean. And unclean is something that was sort of like contagious. And so if one person is unclean and they touch someone else, then that other person becomes unclean. And God says, as long as you're unclean, you can't have any relationship with me until you get clean again. And so God now is talking about his priests, and he says to the priests, you can't become unclean even if a family member dies, unless they're close family, like immediate family, father, mother. He lists it here. He says this, except for a close relative such as his mother or father, his son or daughter, his brother, or an unmarried sister who is dependent on him since she has no husband. If she's married, she needs to be taken care of by her husband. But if she's unmarried, then this guy can take care of her. For her, it says, he may make himself unclean. He must not make himself unclean for people related to him by marriage. So mother-in-laws, if they die, the priest doesn't care. You know, not really, but I mean, he can't show it. So anyway, then it says, and so defile himself. If he becomes unclean, it's called defiling himself. Keep reading. Priests must not shave their heads or shave off the edges of their beards or cut their bodies. They must be holy to their God and must not profane the name of their God because they present the food offerings to the Lord. The food of their God, they are to be holy. They must not marry women defiled by prostitution or divorced from their husbands, because priests are holy to their God. Regard them as holy because they offer up the food of your God. Consider them holy because I, the Lord, am holy, I who make you holy. If a priest's daughter defiles herself by becoming a prostitute, she disgraces her father, she must be burned in the fire. The high priest, the one among his brothers who has had the anointing oil poured on his head and who has been ordained to wear the priestly garments, must not let his hair become unkempt or tear his clothes. He must not enter a place where there is a dead body. He must not make himself unclean, even for his father or mother, nor leave the sanctuary of his God or desecrate it, because he has been dedicated by the anointing oil of his God. I am the Lord. The woman he marries must be a virgin. He must not marry a widow, a divorced woman, a woman defiled by prostitution, but only a virgin from his own people, so that he will not defile his offspring among his people. I'm the Lord who makes him holy. The Lord said to Moses, say to Aaron, for the generations to come, none of your descendants who has a defect may come near to offer the food of his God. No man who has any defect may come near. No man who is blind or lame, disfigured or deformed. No man with a crippled foot or hand, or who is a hunchback or a dwarf, or who has any eye defect, or who has festering or running sores or damaged testicles. No descendant of Aaron the priest who has any defect is to come near to present the food offerings to the Lord. He has a defect. He must not come near to offer the food of his God. He may eat the most holy food of his God, as well as the holy food, yet because of his defect, he must not go near the curtain or approach the altar and so desecrate my sanctuary. I'm the Lord who makes them holy. So Moses told this to Aaron and his sons and all the Israelites. So God here gives restrictions for the priests and also different restrictions for the high priest. Now, what's important here is that we look at this and we recognize that the whole nation of Israel was to represent God, but the priests were to represent God to the nation, and then the high priest was to represent God over the priests. So as a result, the closer you get to God, the more restrictive things get over your life and your behaviors. I want to put it on a chart for you to see the two of them compared side by side, the priests and the high priest. So here it is. First of all, the priests, they can become unclean only for close family deaths. Nothing else. They're not allowed to become unclean for anything else, but for close family deaths, they're allowed to participate in the funeral and the burial. For a high priest, not even for his parents. It doesn't tell us anything about the high priest's wife or his sons or daughters. It doesn't tell us anything about that. It just says, especially for the parents, not even for the parents can the high priest become unclean. Secondly, it says no shaving or cutting in mourning. Now, this is interesting because last week we saw that one passage that talks about you can't cut yourselves or give yourselves tattoos for the dead. Remember that passage last week if you were here? Well, something that I learned this week that I didn't know about last week is that not only were those practices of cutting your hair and cutting your beard and cutting your skin, not only were those practices done in ancient religious circumstances, like for worshiping a foreign god or something, they were also done in mourning. If you had lost a loved one, then quite frequently what you would do is you would show how sad you were by how painful you made your body. You would cut your hair off to make yourself shamed. You would cut your beard off to make yourself shamed. You would cut your hands and your feet and your legs to make yourself feel pain. And you would sit in the public eye in ashes and maybe wearing sackcloth or something with ripped clothing to demonstrate how distraught you were about the death of your loved one. And how much you loved them and how sad you were, it would change how well you did the whole mourning thing. And God says, no, for my priests, you don't get to mourn like normal people. And for the high priest, you can't even have messy hair or torn clothes. For the high priest, you got to keep yourself looking nice. For the regular priest, it's okay to feel sad and to not take a shower in the morning, you know? It's okay for that to sort of, you know, just wake up and you got the bedhead. It's all right. But if you're the high priest, you can't. God says specifically, you represent me. And I'm not crying. See, God knows where people go when they die. He understands that the people who are part of his family go into his presence and the people who have rejected God go out of his presence. He understands that. And so when someone who has entered into God's presence has entered into God's presence, God is like, I'm not really mourning over that. You're representatives of me. You don't get to mourn like normal people. And the high priest, you don't really get to mourn at all. Then, no marrying a divorcee or a prostitute. A priest could marry a widow, but he couldn't marry a divorcee or a prostitute. A high priest could only marry a virgin. He couldn't marry any woman who had ever been with any other guy. Then, for the priest, there's no tolerance of a daughter who gets herself involved in prostitution. She gets killed. But the high priest, he can't even leave the sanctuary area. His entire family has to camp out in the courtyard of the sanctuary area. That's where he lives. He's not allowed to leave there. In fact, when the temple was built later on, they built rooms in the temple for the high priest and his family to actually live inside the temple building. But at this point, God just says, can't leave the sanctuary area. And then finally, priests have to be a perfect, unblemished man. And the high priest also has to be a perfect, unblemished man. We look at this from the lens of our modern society, and a lot of these things don't make sense to us. You know, I'll just be honest with you. I have a title of pastor, but I've never really been interested in having people call me pastor because I like to pretend that I'm normal. I'm not normal. I'm kind of odd. But I like to pretend, at least, that I'm normal. And so the idea of these guys being set apart from everyone else kind of feels weird to me, for them to be sort of put on a pedestal. The idea that they can't mourn feels weird to me. You just lost a loved one. Can't you feel sad? Can't you demonstrate that sadness to the rest of the world? The fact that there's restrictions on who they can and can't marry. Well, what if I fall in love with someone who was previously married? Wouldn't that be? Or what about this whole no leaving the sanctuary? Or the perfect, unblemished men only? You know, we live in a society today where we're like, man, if some guy has a small problem, you know, he's got a wart, he's got a wound, he's got something going on. One leg is a little bit shorter than the other. Maybe he doesn't look all that good. He's not a perfect specimen of a man. We should still let him do something worthwhile with his life, shouldn't we? You know, we live in a society that is very inclusive, kind of a arms open wide society where we simply say, everybody's welcome, come on in. And men only? Almost chauvinistic that God would say that. Listen, from our modern society, we can look at this stuff like the person who stands in face-to-face contrast with an unrealistic expectation and say, God just is wrong. Or we can say, God has standards that are way higher than mine, way different than mine. In fact, the whole notion of these two chapters are to push us in that direction. Let's look at chapter 22. And I'm not going to be able to read all of chapter 22. I'm just going to pick up a few things from it. But in chapter 22, let's start at the beginning. The Lord said to Moses, "Tell Aaron and his sons to treat with respect the sacred offerings the Israelites consecrate to me, so they will not profane my holy name." So God is going to start talking about the sacrifices. But before he talks about the sacrifices, he's going to talk a little bit more about the people who make the sacrifices, the people who bring the sacrifices. "Say to them, for the generations to come, if any of your descendants is ceremonially unclean and yet comes near the sacred offerings that the Israelites consecrate to the Lord, that person must be cut off from my presence. I'm the Lord. If a descendant of Aaron has a defiling skin disease or a bodily discharge, he may not eat the sacred offerings until he's cleansed. He will also be unclean if he touches something defiled by a corpse or by anyone who has an emission of semen, or if he touches any crawling thing that makes him unclean, or any person who makes him unclean, whatever the uncleanness may be." God's got some really interesting requirements there. He's like, if you get unclean for any reason whatsoever, stay away from me. The one who touches anything will be unclean till evening. He must not eat any of the sacred offerings until he has bathed himself with water. When the sun goes down, he will be clean, and after that he may eat the sacred offerings, for they're his food. He must not eat anything found dead or torn by wild animals and so become unclean through it. I am the Lord. The priests are to perform my service in such a way that they do not become guilty and die for treating it with contempt. I'm the Lord who makes them holy. Verse 10, no one outside a priest's family may eat the sacred offering, nor may the guest of a priest or his hired worker eat it. Unless you are part of his family, the priest's family, you can't eat from this offering. You're just not allowed to. Then he says, but if a priest buys a slave with money, or if slaves are born in his household, they may eat his food. If a priest's daughter marries anyone other than a priest, she may not eat any of the sacred contributions. But if a priest's daughter becomes a widow or is divorced, yet has no children, and she returns to live in her father's household as in her youth, she may eat her father's food. No unauthorized person, however, may eat it. No one's allowed to participate in the priest's food unless you actually are a priest. Skip on down a little bit in verse 17. It says this, speak to Aaron and his sons and to all the Israelites and say to them, if any of you, whether an Israelite or a foreigner residing in Israel, presents a gift for a burnt offering to the Lord, either to fulfill a vow or as a freewill offering, you must present a male without defect from the cattle, sheep, or goats in order that it may be accepted on your behalf. Do not bring anything with a defect because it will not be accepted on your behalf. God says the sacrifices have to be absolutely blemish-free, perfect. You see, both Leviticus 21 and Leviticus 22 make a point that I think is incredible and important for us to get. It's this: for God, when it comes to God and his requirements, priests and sacrifices must be perfect. Nothing else works. Priests and sacrifices must be perfect. Now, that's God having a really high standard. A really high standard. How do you respond to such a standard? If I'm going to represent God, if the Bible calls me a representative of God, an agent of God, a priest, then that means who I am and what I offer to God has to be perfect. You know, some people view this passage through the lens of what we talked about earlier. Some people are perfectionists, and they take the approach that says, God says this, and you have to do this, and we all have to do this. And the parts of this that I don't do are the parts I choose to forget about, but I'm a perfectionist, And so we all have to do this. And you get people who would flip through the pages of Leviticus and they would say, you can't eat this kind of meat. You have to worship on this kind of day. You can't do this. You can't do that. They just portray God as a guy who's got a long list of don'ts. And you need to make sure that your don't list is the same as their don't list. And you have to actually keep it. They're the perfectionists. There's some people who come to God with a pragmatic mentality, and they say, God, I will do the best that I can. But where I fall short, you're just going to have to give in. I'll just do the best that I can, and God, if you expect more than that, you're wrong. Because you're asking the impossible, and I can't do that. And then there's another category of people, and they have given up on God altogether. Because God, the guy who seems like he's all uptight about tiny little details, they realize, man, it's just impossible. I'm just going to give up altogether. And I'm not going to try to live in any way that honors God. I'm just going to completely ignore it. What kind of person are you when you come face to face with astronomically high standards? A God who would demand perfection. Well, before you really answer that question for yourself, I want to share with you a few more verses from the same chapters we just looked at, but to highlight them so you can see the second layer of things that are going on in this passage. First, in Leviticus 21, verse 3, we find this little line. It says, or an unmarried sister who's dependent on him, since she has no husband, for her he may make himself unclean. The priest can only be a man. So God takes special time to make sure he's going to care about the women in his life. See, just because God says, I want my priests to be men, it does not in any way say that God values men more than women. He says, no, you might have a sister who's dead. You should go ahead and get unclean to take care of her. You might have a sister who has passed on. You should honor her by getting unclean from my perspective and taking care of her. You should be unclean in that kind of case. It's amazing that God would highlight that. Now, let's look at another one. In Leviticus 21:22, it says, a man with a defect may eat the most holy food of his God as well as the holy food. God's standard is perfection. And if you have a defect, you can't be a priest. If you have a defect, you can't serve the food. You can't make the sacrifice. You can't do these things. But God will let you participate in eating the food. Only priests can eat the sacrificial food. And if you have a defect, you're still a priest. You're still allowed to participate. Interesting. Keep going. In 22 verse 6, we see this. The one who touches any such thing will be unclean till evening. He must not eat any of the sacred offerings unless he has bathed himself with water. When the sun goes down, he will be clean. And after that, he may eat the sacred offerings for there his food. God says, listen, I want you to be perfect. You have to be perfect if you're going to be my priest. And if you ever get unclean, if anything ever goes bad with you and you end up getting unclean, wash with water and it'll be just that night when you get clean again. It's amazing that God would say, I have to have perfection. So if you mess up, wash with water and when the sun sets, then you'll be fine again. Keep going. Because in verse 22:11, it says this, but if a priest buys a slave with money, or if slaves are born in his household, they may eat his food. Do you see what that says? A priest who has a guest, the guest can't eat the food. A priest who has a hired worker can't eat the food. A priest who has someone showing up in his house who's not part of his household can't eat the food. But a priest who has a slave, the slave does eat the food. The priest and his family only are the ones who eat the priest's food. And a slave who lives in the house is also allowed to participate. If it's not clear to you, God is saying by this, that if you have a slave, you treat them like family. That is the way God says you're supposed to treat a slave. If you have a slave, some people are all upset about the book of Leviticus because, hey, Leviticus allows slavery. Yeah, it allows slavery in a way you've never seen before. God says, if you buy someone into your household, you have bought them into your family. In some respects, this is more adoption than it is slavery. God is like, if you use money to bring someone into your household, they and everyone else who's born to them, they are family. Don't you dare treat them like they are anything less. Keep going, because in the next verse, we read this. In verse 13, it says, but if a priest's daughter becomes a widow or is divorced, yet has no children, and she returns to live in her father's household as in her youth, she may eat her father's food. No unauthorized person, however, may eat it. God here again confirms that only the family members can eat. And here's a woman, and she's left the family because she got married, and then that guy dumped her. And in that society back then, she would have been disgraced. But God says, no, you don't. You bring her back in. You welcome her back in. She is family. She gets to participate in the family. And then one more. In verse 23 of chapter 22, it says, you may, however, present a freewill offering of an ox or a sheep that is deformed or still have a place. See, God says, you can't offer a sacrifice that is deformed in general. But there is one type of sacrifice that, yes, you may offer a deformed sacrifice. See, God is a God of perfection. And yet somehow in the midst of his demanding perfection, he's also got open arms. Write that down. God demands perfection, but he does it with open arms. You can almost hear God saying to his people, listen, I'm holy. The only people who can come to me are perfect people. So come here. It's a very weird thing to imagine God saying. And yet his idea of perfection somehow is still open-armed and is asking people to come in. To prove that point, let's look at the very last verse of chapter 22. It says this, keep my commands and follow them. I am the Lord. Do not profane my holy name. For I must be acknowledged as holy by the Israelites. I am the Lord who made you holy and who brought you up out of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord. You see, God demands perfection, but his perfection demands are not just a moral code. You have to do this or I kick you out. His commands are a symbolic action. You represent me by demonstrating who I am to the world. And so he doesn't give you commands that are too hard for you. He doesn't give you commands that are impossible for you. This is the God who said to the universe, let there be light, and there was. This is the God who speaks into nowhere, words of creation, and it happens. And this is the God who made his people holy. He says, I'm the one who found you languishing in slavery in Egypt. And I came to you and I brought you out and I loved you and I declared that you are mine. And I declared that because I am holy and you are my people, I declare that you are holy and I will make you holy. And he gives them these rules and regulations not to prove that they aren't holy, but because they are holy, he says, you are my people, and I have made you holy. Write this down. God demands perfection, and then he makes a way for it to happen. He demands perfection and then makes a way for it to happen. I bet you didn't expect to hear this from Leviticus, but this is the most important concept in the entire Bible. It is, in fact, the most important concept in the history of humankind, that God himself is absolutely, unimaginably holy and perfect. And he demands that his followers, his people, and his world be absolutely and totally perfect. And then he makes it happen. I want to show you some passages from the New Testament that highlight this very thought. The first one is in the book of Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 7 and a section from chapter 10. I'm only giving you these two verses out of context. I encourage you to read it on your own. If I read it out loud, Hebrews is one of those books that when you read it out loud, it just begins to turn into mush, because it's got a lot of complicated kind of thoughts and logic in it. But there are a couple verses, a couple key verses that stand out like a sore thumb for how clear they are. And so I want to show them to you here. One from chapter 7, one from chapter 10. They say this: for the law appoints as high priests men in their weakness. See, you and I know this. Even though on the outside these particular high priests might have looked perfect, even though they might have accomplished all the uncleanness sorts of prevention that they needed to, even though they might have been perfect, we all know that they're not. We all know that people aren't perfect. They mess up all the time. Who knows what that high priest is thinking? He's got a mental problem. He's got a psychological problem, perhaps. He's got a weight problem, perhaps. We don't know what his issue is, but we know he's not perfect. And the guy who writes Hebrews just simply acknowledges that. No matter how perfect they might have looked on the outside, they're still just men of weakness. But the oath, a promise he's referring to that comes from the mouth of David in the Psalms, where God says, I will cause my one chosen man to be my son, my chosen individual to rule the nations. He's referring to this promise. And so the writer of Hebrews says, but the oath which came after the law appointed the son who has been made perfect forever. You see, Jesus lived a life that was perfect. And then when he died, he crossed the finish line of perfection, because he's now done with the life. He can rise again and he can continue on in perfection because he never messed up. And so he's perfect forever. And then in chapter 10, it says this: for by one sacrifice, he's still talking about Jesus, he has made perfect forever those who are being made holy. Listen, you have to grasp this. Jesus dies on the cross to make one sacrifice as the one high priest who is perfect, to make one perfect sacrifice for all human beings forever. And it says here that that sacrifice is to make perfect forever those who are being made holy. Jesus is at work to make people holy forever. I want to show you another verse. This verse comes from 1 Corinthians. It says this: or do you not know, remember Paul the apostle is writing this one, he says, or do you not know that wrongdoers will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither the sexually immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor men who have sex with men, nor thieves, nor greedy, nor drunkards, nor slanders, nor swindlers will inherit the kingdom of God. All he's doing there is he's quoting the chapters we've already looked at. He's quoting the chapters we've already looked at in Leviticus, you know, chapters 18 and 19 and 20. He's just quoting those chapters to us that we would see God really doesn't want anyone like that to be in his family. And the very next line says this, and that's what some of you were. God won't accept any of these people into his kingdom, and that's what some of you were. But, one of the greatest buts in the Bible, but you were washed. You were sanctified, a word that means to be made holy. You were justified, a word that means to be made right, in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and by the Spirit of our God. Past tense. That's what some of you were. But you were washed. Your washing has already happened. You were sanctified. Your being made holy has already happened. You were justified. Your being made right with God has already happened because of Jesus and the work that has happened in your life through his Spirit. Listen, I want to give you something that you can take home with yourself today, because this is the most important concept, not just in the Bible, not just in human history, but in your life. God demands total perfection, and he has made a way for it to be true of you because of what Jesus has done. I'm going to give you three things. Number one, I want you to become aware of God's standard. I know some of you come to this place today and you're like, God's standards feel unreasonably high and I just want to blame him, or I just want to maybe ignore it altogether. Or maybe some of you are saying, God's standards are unreasonably high and so I got to work harder and work harder and work harder and work harder and work harder to make it. And I got to tell you, all three of these perspectives are wrong. Because see, as a matter of fact, his standards are too high. You can't measure up. You know how I know that? Because you haven't. From this point forward, you already aren't perfect. So therefore, how many more questions do you have to get right on a test in order to get 100% with a teacher who actually knows math? It's not going to happen. You can never get to perfect from imperfect. No matter how hard you do it, no matter how hard you work, we have already failed our own standards. I can't even keep a diet for more than a day and a half. Why in the world could we think that we can accomplish the perfection that God demands? I want you to be aware of the incredibly high standards that God has. You need to know that. But I also want you to become convinced of God's gift of cleansing. See, there are two basic approaches that you can have today. Some of you in this room have never received this gift before. You're just beginning to learn that God has high standards, that standards are too high for you, that you can't measure up. You're just beginning to learn that. And so for some of you, you need to come at this to say, wait a minute, God actually offers cleansing. God actually offers forgiveness and renewal and healing. He offers perfection somehow. And you need to understand that God is actually handing that to you. Some of you, every single morning, you're like, man, I don't know if I can measure up to God's standards. God is just too much for me. And maybe you wake up with a sense of inadequacy or guilt or shame. I can't measure up. No matter what you are, you could say, wait a minute, God is offering a gift of cleansing. Some of you have never received it. And you need to say, God, today is the day I'm going to receive your gift of cleansing. Would you make me new? Would you make me into the perfect person you want me to be? Somehow I don't understand it, but would you do the work? Some of you did it a long time ago. Some of you actually have gone through some process in your life where you gave your life over to God and you said, God, would you cleanse me? And he did, but you've forgotten it. And so you wake up every day saying to yourself, I just can't do it. I'm going to just pretend one more day. Maybe today I'll start feeling it. Maybe this week I'll go to church and something will happen and I'll begin to get my act together. I don't know. Maybe I just shouldn't try anymore. Maybe it's not worth my time. I got to let you know, the cleansing is past tense. And I want you to wake up every morning saying, wait a minute. If I start today perfect, what does it just mean to stay there? And if I happen to get unclean again, it'll only last till sundown. It'll only last until I come back to God and say, God, would you cleanse me again? I want you to receive, truly receive, God's incredible gift of cleansing. And then finally, I want you to give your life to the sanctifying work of Jesus. See, he has died so that you could be cleansed, so that you could be declared right, so that you could be made perfect. And from this moment forward, every moment in your life is one more moment for you to get closer to Jesus, one more moment for him to work that work of becoming holy in your life, one more moment. See, if you go tomorrow and you make the world's biggest mistake, or you go tomorrow and you make the world's biggest success, either one doesn't matter in the sense that both of them can make you more holy. If you have a success tomorrow, you come back to Jesus and you say, wow, Jesus, we did it once. You know, can you just give me the strength to help me do it again? That one day when that guy yelled at me and I held my tongue and I spoke a word of love back to him, God, you helped me. You helped me accomplish something I couldn't accomplish by myself. Would you give me the strength to do it one more day? And if you make a mistake, it still is an opportunity for holiness. God, I made this really big mistake, so I'm coming back to you. I know that's not the way you want me to be, and so I'm coming back to you. Would you cleanse me? Would you heal me? Would you make me holy again and give me the strength to move on away from that? It doesn't matter. Jesus wants to make you perfect, and you don't have to give up. You don't have to step off to the side and say, whatever, God, I don't care anymore. And you don't have to blame God for having standards that are way too high for you. Nor do you have to worry about all the tiny little details to say, what's the next checkbox I have to get so that God will like me? No, you are already perfect. So allow yourself to become it every day by letting Jesus sanctify you, change you, transform you, and make you more like him. God's standards are incredibly high, unimaginably high. Perfect. But he has made a way for perfect to be true for you. I want to invite you today to receive that perfection to be applied to your life. On the card that is next to you, you can mark a checkbox right there that says, I want to follow Jesus with my life. If today is your day to receive that cleansing, then put a mark on that checkbox and say, Jesus, I want to receive your cleansing and start afresh from this day forward. Maybe you've done that in the past, it was a private thing, and now you want to go public with it. Mark the box that says, I want to be baptized. Get me more information about being baptized, because you want to be a person who says, I want to let the world know that, yes, I have been cleansed. It is a past tense thing that Jesus has done, and now I want to walk in that purity with him. Whatever it is for you, I want to give you the opportunity right now to reflect with you and God and to say, God, what does this mean for my life? What does it mean for me to receive the cleansing and to walk in the sanctifying work of Jesus? Let me pray for you. Heavenly Father, we recognize that we are not what you intended for us to be. We can't even measure up to our own standards, much less yours. We could spend all kinds of time trying to talk about which Old Testament commands make sense to us and which Old Testament commands don't make sense to us. And it would be a waste of our time, because, God, it's just simply very clear that even the ones that make perfect sense to us, we still don't do. We don't measure up. So we thank you for a Jesus who does. We thank you for one high priest who was perfect, who made the perfect sacrifice that we could be made perfect in your sight. Lord, I pray that you would wash over us now in this moment and help us to become convinced of the fact that Jesus can, will, or has cleansed us, that we might walk in a way that honors you with the rest of our lives. Would you speak into our hearts now as we reflect in your presence? We pray in Jesus' name. I want to encourage you to spend a few moments, jot down some thoughts on that card, reflect, spend some time in prayer. What is God speaking into your heart right now in this moment? And then as we sing this final bit of music, I just encourage you to join us to stand, to sing, to celebrate the work that God is doing in your life.
Thank you for listening to this message from Lafayette Community Church. We believe that God has a full and fulfilling life in store for you, and we want to help you live it. If you have any questions, feel free to contact me, Pastor Jeff, through the web form at lafayettecommunitychurch.com. And as always, I encourage you to plug into a solid, God-honoring community wherever you may be. Life is a journey, and no one should ever walk alone.